call our first case today. State v. Krajewski, is it?
Krajewski.
Okay. And Mr. Andereg will be our first counsel representing the defendant. Thank you. 99-3165 CR State v. Krajewski. Counsel?
Good morning, Justices, Counsel. May it please the Court, my name is Rex Andereg, and I appear today on behalf of the defendant, respondent, petitioner, Jay Krajewski. On May 20th, 1999, in Jefferson County, Mr. Krajewski was stopped and arrested for operating while intoxicated, fifth offense. After the arrest, he was transported to the Countryside Nursing Home, asked, pursuant to the implied consent law, to submit to a blood test. Mr. Krajewski declined, bringing to an end a procedure for chemical test collection under Section 343.305. The arresting officer, however, still wanted to get a blood test for Mr. Krajewski and advised Mr. Krajewski that he'd be taking one forcibly if need be. Test would be taken pursuant to other constitutional means, as this court discussed in the Zilke case. Under the exigent circumstances exception to the warrant requirement, as this court discussed in Bowling.
Counsel, you've raised a question that I was going to wait for a while, but since you've raised it, does the state have the right to forcibly withdraw blood upon a refusal under Chapter 343?
I don't believe they have the right to do that forcibly under Chapter 343.305. I see that as a forcible search and seizure from the defendant's body, and I don't find that right existing under statutory authorization.
Well, why did you raise that as an objection? Because, as I understand it, under those statutes, if a defendant refuses to allow blood, breath, or urine, the penalty is revocation, not automatic forcible withdrawal. Did you raise that as an argument in any of the courts?
I don't believe that was raised specifically as an argument at the trial court level. I think it probably exists by inference. But there is no statutory authorization for a forcible blood draw. And I know there
was... Is it constitutional? Let's forget the statute. Suppose there's no statute and you need blood to for evidence of a crime. And you've got probable cause here, right, to think a crime was committed?
Yeah, we've conceded probable cause.
And you can ordinarily search a person for probable cause without a warrant, right?
Under certain circumstances.
Right. So if it's exigent, can't you take the blood? Constitutional.
If there are exigent circumstances and probable cause, you can take the blood constitutionally.
Without consent.
Without consent.
Even in the light of the statute?
Well, I think...
Does the statute at least arguably give greater rights?
Well, the statute could arguably give greater rights to the defendant under these circumstances. But since the statute is sort of silent on the issue... we recur then to the constitutional doctrines that allow searches in these types of situations.
The statute isn't silent. The statute says that the penalty for refusal is forfeiture of license.
Well, that's true. That is a penalty for the refusal. As I stated one before, I guess one could infer from that the statute is the last and final word on the matter. And therefore... that's the only consequence which can flow from this. But we're talking about not so much a penalty as we are in terms of evidence collection. And I think in that regard, that's why we're getting into this constitutional doctrine.
Counsel, I understood part of your argument, especially when you're discussing the Bowling case, which is a prime focus of your argument, that... an examination, reading from page 19 of your brief, an examination of whether forcible blood draw is reasonable under the circumstances has to be addressed. And I make this comment following up on Justice Babich's question. I mean, I understand a part of your argument is that the third and fourth prong of Bowling are not met. The third prong requires a reasonable seizure, and that whether a forcible blood draw is reasonable under the circumstances certainly has to be addressed. That's what I understood your argument in part to be.
That's correct. I think that, and this is, in my opinion, the sort of summary disposition that we had on this case from the Court of Appeals sort of overlooked the fact that this court, in deciding Bowling, did not judicially supplant the overarching reasonableness that's at the core of every Fourth Amendment analysis. And so whether one views this reasonableness as existing outside and independent of the four-prong test in Bowling, or whether one views this reasonableness test as being incorporated within the four prongs, it's there. And that was the problem with this particular blood draw, that it was not reasonable under the circumstances.
Also, do you have any argument with the proposition that the state is the person that designates the test? I know that in Nelson, which you cited on page 2 of your brief, which Judge Irwin recited, the Nelson case came out of a situation where it was based on the California traffic code. Now, Wisconsin seems to be a little different, that as I read 343.05, it says that the law enforcement agency may designate which of the tests shall be administered first. And it would seem that the law enforcement agency has control over which test would be appropriate. Is that, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I say that the issue before this court has very little to do with the implied consent law, really. We are in no way advocating that suspects should be able to designate what the primary test is, and that this court's decision will in no way change the administration of the implied consent law. And that's because the issue that we have here today comes to fruition only after the implied consent law has sort of run its course. And in fact, the issue here arises only after the implied consent law process ends with a refusal. And we could spend a lot of time discussing how the state really loses nothing because it can charge a refusal, vindicate society's interest in protecting society and punishing OWI offenders with a longer mandatory revocation period of operating privileges, longer waiting period for occupational license, use of the fact of the refusal at the underlying OWI trial as consciousness of guilt. But we focus on the process that gets us to this point, and we sort of lose sight of the issue. No matter how this court decides this issue, the state is still going to be able to designate the primary test. The suspect is still either going to submit to that test or withdraw his or her consent and face the refusal with all the attendant consequences. And at this stage, in the implied consent process, if the defendant says, well, I don't really want to do blood for whatever reason, but I'd be willing to submit to a breath test, that's still going to be a refusal, and you're still within the implied consent context. But once that process is complete, the authority for testing no longer rests on any sort of statutory empowerment. It comes from the exigent circumstances, the constitutional doctrine. And it's only when we enter this realm that the suspect's willingness to take a breath test affects the calculus of what is reasonable under those circumstances. So I would want to point out today to this court that if Mr. Krajewski's position is accepted by this court, the very worst case scenario here in terms of gathering evidence, is that the state will emerge with a refusal charge and a chemical test. And while at the same...
Now I'm making sense of this. You are saying, you are essentially, it seems to me, conceding that there was a refusal, and consistent with the statute, the state could now bring charges upon that refusal.
That is correct. And once the refusal was a fact, implied consent process terminated, the officer then went forward at that point, but he was only going forward under a constitutional doctrine. And exigent circumstances was the doctrine that was at play here, as discussed in the court's decision in Bowling. And to get back to something that you mentioned, Justice Wilcox, you're right. In terms of the Nelson versus City of Irvine case, California law is different. And that's why we don't rely on Nelson in this particular case. While we think it's persuasive, its logic is compelling, we recognize that the implied consent law in California is different because it allows the defendant in those particular circumstances to choose the method by which they will give a chemical sample. However, the question being asked at this court today has nothing to do with the implied consent law. So the question is without reference to implied consent law or statutes or administrative regulations.
I'm having trouble understanding why the implied consent law is not at issue in this case. I'm thinking of the remedy that you've asked for in this case. The remedy that you've asked for is suppression of the results. I'm especially thinking of that remedy in light of two cases that we decided last term. One case is State versus Pittington, which had to do with the implied consent law, and we made it very clear in that case that the result of a violation is not always suppression of the evidence. The other case we decided last term is State versus Eason, which has to do, of course, with the good faith exception and has to do with when it's appropriate to suppress evidence. Now, taking those two cases in mind, how do you distinguish those cases? Why are we in a situation where the remedy here should be suppression of the evidence?
Well, I think generally speaking, the remedy for any violation of the Fourth Amendment is going to be suppression. I don't think that this case appropriately would come under the rubric of a good faith exception. This always comes back to sort of the reasonableness of the circumstances. And under these particular circumstances, you've got a defendant who is, or a suspect, who is willing to voluntarily provide a chemical test sample. And in a chemical test sample, which, by the way, is of equal evidentiary value as the one that the officer would prefer to take. On the other hand, you have an officer who wants to forcibly extract blood from an individual, strap down to a gurney if need be, and don't want to over-dramatize the situation. But
that wasn't necessary here, though, was it?
It was not necessary in this particular case, and my experience is that it's normally not necessary when an individual is faced with that sort of Hobson's choice, if you will. They allow the blood to be drawn. But I think the circumstances of this case is, as I recall, in the Easton case that you referenced, the officer had a warrant that he, in good faith, executed on, a no-knock warrant. But in this particular case, I don't believe we have those types of circumstances. We have an officer who's in the field who we expect to exercise discretion and act reasonably. And I think that it was not reasonable under the circumstances of this case.
Is there a policy with the department involved here to generally get blood tests rather than breath tests?
I believe that there was a policy that on offense of this magnitude or at this level, that blood would be designated as the primary test in terms of the implied consent law.
So the officer was acting consistent with the policy of his or her department?
The officer, to my knowledge, was acting consistent with departmental policy. I'm not aware of anything in the record that indicates that this officer's department had a policy that they shouldn't take blood. And, of course, once the implied consent process was complete and there had been a refusal, and the officer wanted to sort of forcibly take a sample anyways, blood was really the only option.
Let's assume that, they did take blood. Does the statute then allow a prosecution not only for the refusal, but also for the offense of driving of OWI?
Well, I can tell you from experience that we see that all the time, prosecutions in both cases.
With a forcible withdrawing of blood?
Yes. I have not been able to, although I'd like to, construe the statute in a way that would mean that if a refusal is prosecuted, then you can't prosecute a prohibited alcohol concentration charge.
So if a defendant refuses to take the test, that's a violation in and of itself.
Right.
And then upon refusal, the police can wrestle them to the ground or do whatever is necessary to withdraw blood. And if that blood tests at point better than 0.08, they can also charge him with drunken driving and use that blood sample as the evidence.
That's correct. And use the effect of the refusal in the underlying OWI trial.
What's wrong? What's unreasonable with the following up on Justice Babbage's question? What's unreasonable with law enforcement forcibly withdrawing blood or wrestling him to the ground? Not that that happened in this case, but wrestling someone to the ground to forcibly withdraw blood from them after they refuse the test. What's unreasonable with that kind of seizure?
Well, personally, I depending on the amount of force used, I might have some moral objections to the reasonableness of it, but from a legal perspective, based on the law that exists and the precedent that we have, nothing is unreasonable about it if there are exigent circumstances, but it becomes unreasonable when a person essentially says, not in so many words, hey, you don't have to wrestle me to the ground, you don't have to strap me to a gurney, you don't have to stick a needle in my arm, I'd be happy to give you a breath test. Under those circumstances, then it becomes very, very unreasonable.
What if, not as in this case, but what if, hypothetically, someone says, I'll take the breath test, but it's well beyond, or a breath test isn't available. Machine is down.
Well, then the exigency doesn't dissipate, and the officer would be reasonable to take blood under those circumstances.
Isn't it true that breath tests can be manipulated in ways that blood tests cannot, and that's the basis of the police department's policy to prefer blood tests, particularly with offenses? I think the policy was a third offense and beyond, or was it a fourth offense and beyond, that they would prefer blood tests, and that breath tests, in terms of their admissibility in court, are required to pass through more evidentiary hoops than blood tests.
Well, that's an argument that's been advanced by the state, and I would, I guess, as an initial observation, say that through practical, through my own experience, I find that argument somewhat disingenuous because having done a lot of drunk driving trials involving breath tests and having heard testimony about how wonderful and unassailable these machines are and accurate and so forth, it's kind of ironic to have the state now argue that, well, they're really not so good after all, that's why we want blood.
My question went to the capacity for manipulation.
Manipulation in what sense?
Well, a suspect can easily manipulate a breath test and thereby take himself outside of the three-hour period of reliability for these chemical tests by so doing. That's not possible with a blood test.
I see. So I understand your question. You're sort of worried about the suspect not providing a sufficient sample, and then maybe we got to start all over to the 20-minute observation period and
not cooperating.
Next thing you know, we're running out of time.
Right.
Well, my response to that would be that reasonableness is a two-way street. If the officer, through his observations, has subjective information that he believes this suspect is engaging in dilatory tactics, then the exigency has not dissipated, and he would be perfectly within his rights to say, to truncate that process and say, we're not putting up with this, we're going to draw blood and forcibly take blood.
Right, but why should he be required to do that? Take the suspect to the police station or wherever the breathalyzer is located and put the suspect through the paces and go through the whole process of having the suspect manipulate the process such that the three-hour deadline is fast approaching, and then have to take the suspect to the hospital for a blood draw and perhaps miss that time limit.
Well, and that's another argument advanced by the state, and that argument, like a number of arguments which the state advanced, I think really is sort of a kind of a disguised public policy argument. And these kinds of arguments, and this one in particular, I think lose sight of the fact that the Fourth Amendment was crafted as a constraint to limit and control the authority of the state to act without a warrant. And we have exceptions. We have plain view, consent, community caretaker, and so forth. But there is no public policy exception to the Fourth Amendment. There is no what's easiest or best for the state exception to the warrant requirement of the Fourth Amendment. And I mean, the plain view exception exists because we recognize that an individual who leaves something out in plain view doesn't have a privacy interest in something like that.
Plain view, I'm just extending this. In many of these cases, and I have sat on the trial bench for a number of years before I came here, I recall that people that are intoxicated, when they would open the door, they'd fall out on the ground. I'm just asking from a plain view standpoint, it depends on the circumstances, what the officer may observe, or tremendously erratic driving, erratic, but then so to be dangerous to the public. This is within the plain view exception. Now, that could apply here, not going into the facts, but this was, I don't know whether they'd had prior knowledge, but when they read this out, they saw that this gentleman had, I believe, 5 prior convictions. Now, this isn't a pretextual consideration, but it depends on the circumstances that they find the defendant in, under plain view.
Yeah, I would agree that everything that the officer observes is something that has to be weighed into the reasonableness analysis. And to use another example, perhaps the officer has found drug paraphernalia in the vehicle, or has found some drugs, or has smelled an odor, or sees erratic behavior which is inconsistent with his observations of intoxication, or sees bad driving but doesn't smell intoxicants. The officer, under those circumstances, may articulate a reason for trying to do a warrantless blood draw, because he wants blood because he can screen for drugs. Under those circumstances, if the officer has a reasonable and objective grounds for doing that, and the defendant says, well, I don't really want to have a blood draw because I'm afraid of needles, but I will give a breath test. Well, a breath test is not going to test for any of those controlled substances, and therefore, again, the exigency has not dissipated.
Mr. Hendrick, don't you think we've got exigent circumstances in this case? You've got a policy by the department telling the officer that they prefer that with the fifth offense, I think it was in this case, that there be a blood draw. There's a substantial time that would be needed in order to obtain a search warrant. There's the problem with dissipation of alcohol. Why doesn't that situation, exactly as we had it in this case, provide the exigent circumstances for the draw of blood?
Because the exigency is more than just the dissipation of alcohol in the bloodstream. That's another one of the state's arguments. They define.
Well, the time for warrant is there as well. The time to get a search warrant is there. And as I read Schmerber and I read Bowling, it seems to me that they're both based on this idea that you've got exigent circumstances because you've got time that's needed to obtain a search warrant, and what's going on in the meantime is the dissipation of alcohol. That's exactly what we have here. And you add to that the policy of the department that with a fifth offense, there ought to be a blood draw. Isn't the officer acting reasonably and then proceeding to get a blood draw?
Well, first of all, we have to remember that this court's holding in this case has to be directed to the facts of this case. And the facts of this case, as found by the trial court, was that there was no time constraint. And as a practical matter, there's not going to be a time constraint anytime you're within the 3 hours, because we have the statute 885.235, which says any test taken within that time period can be presumed to be the accurate reflection of the defendant's alcohol concentration at the time of driving.
But the time constraint that the Judge Irwin was looking at was the time constraint in terms of transporting and getting a breath test. That doesn't take away from the other exigent circumstances. You still need time if you're going to get a search warrant. And here the policy is to get a blood draw, and you still have the dissipation of alcohol occurring. So her focus is somewhat different than the question I'm asking you.
Well, you're always going to have dissipation of alcohol, and if the argument is that because a delay could reduce, is that your point? That
sure.
I would point out that, first of all, and I guess my time is out, so I'll wrap this up quick.
Finish answering the question.
Depending on where the defendant is on the blood alcohol curve, the delay might actually increase. He may actually register higher. I would also point out there are some jurisdictions, and Watertown comes to mind, where they have the nurse come from the hospital to the police station. In that particular instance, the delay would actually result in the test being taken later rather than earlier. But if we're going to presume that a delay is going to lower the blood alcohol concentration, well, I guess we have to accept at some point that the constraints imposed by the Fourth Amendment is going to make things a little bit more difficult for the government at times, and that's just an unacceptable fact, but an important part of our Constitution.
Thank you, Mr. Andrick. You've got 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ms. Nashold, Jennifer Nashold, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin. Ms. Nashold.
May it please the court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Jennifer Nashold, and I represent the state of Wisconsin in this matter. In the defendant's reply brief, the focus really comes down to this. Whenever a suspect agrees to take a test, an evidentiary test, that is different from that requested by the officer, exigent circumstances cease to exist, and the officer cannot administer the test that he or she first chose. Therefore, the whole issue of whether the defendant is afraid of needles and that inquiry is not even addressed in this analysis. The fundamental position is that there are no exigent circumstances anymore. this position is simply incorrect. The interpretation of exigent circumstances has no basis in law. The test for exigent circumstances examines whether there is time to get a warrant. And this court has stated in Bowling and the U.S. Supreme Court has stated in Schmerber that because of the dissipation of alcohol, exigent circumstances exist.
Hey, may I stop you at the moment? You agree then with the defendant that the issue here is a Fourth Amendment constitutional issue, not under the statute?
I agree with that.
Okay. And now I'm going to ask you about both. In Bowling, the issue in this case, as I'm reading right from the first lines of the case, is whether the fact that the percentage of alcohol in a person's bloodstream rapidly diminishes after drinking stops alone constitutes a sufficient exigency under the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution in Article 1, Section 11 of the Wisconsin Constitution to justify a warrantless blood draw. Okay? Now, the court answered that no, unless the four elements it set forth is satisfied, right?
That's right.
So exigent circumstances, namely a blanket rule that that alcohol diminishes in the bloodstream, which is the exigent circumstance, that's a blanket rule, right? That's what you're asking for.
Exigent circumstances exist where a person is lawfully arrested,
right,
for OWI,
right,
and there's a clear indication that
he's intoxicated,
right? That so the blood will produce evidence of
a crime. That's a blanket rule for everybody. Those are exigent circumstances.
It's a physiological reality that alcohol is dissipating in the bloodstream.
Is the state then asking for that kind of blanket rule that in every drunk driving case, circumstances are exigent because of dissipation of alcohol, therefore the state can draw blood, period?
I believe where the court is going is Richard's.
Right, it's a trap.
Right.
Okay, I'll spring it, all right?
Yes, well, the difference between this case and Richards is that there is no question that there is a physiological reality that alcohol dissipates.
That wasn't my trap.
Okay.
You got out of
different
there.
Different trap, okay.
No, different trap. The trap is right in Bowling, I think. Maybe it's not a trap. Consequently, a warrantless blood sample taken in the direction of law enforcement is permissible under the following circumstances. This is Bowling. So it requires more than exigent circumstances, as I read Bowling.
Right. There are four criteria that
right.
have to be met.
Four. Blood is taken for intoxication, lawfully arrested. We got that. That's right. Satisfied here. Two. Clear indication that the blood draw will produce evidence of intoxication. I don't think that's an issue here. Right?
Right.
Three. The method used is reasonable one and performed in a reasonable manner. That was raised by the court in this, you know, wrestling him to the ground kind of thing. And the defendant deals with reasonable. So that may be an issue, right?
I don't think that is an issue because that criterion specifically states the method used to take the blood sample is a reasonable one and performed in a reasonable manner. So it doesn't say the test used was a reasonable one. It examines the blood draw and whether, so, you know, was the needle a dirty needle? Did they comply with procedures? That sort of thing. It doesn't say, was this test reasonable? It refers to blood tests.
That leads me to the fourth, which does. But the arrestee presents no reasonable objection to the blood draw. Well, here, the guy said, I'm afraid of needles. Does that fit under four?
I don't believe it does, based on Court of Appeals decision in Krause, and from a practical standpoint, the defendant presented no objective basis for that fear. This was not a situation where the people who are administering the tests were doing so in unsanitary or worrisome conditions. There was no indication that the people administering the test did not comply with standard procedures, and the defendant presented no grounds for that whatsoever. It was a bald assertion.
Does it need to be objective? Suppose I am peculiar, and that the sight of a needle, I'll faint. It's not a reasonable response to the needle.
The state's position.
And the other way is that on drawing blood, I faint, or become physically ill. Now, that's not the usual.
It's not the usual situation.
But it's subjective. That can happen. People
subjective.
Are like that. Is that
and,
enough?
I would respond that this should mirror the implied consent statute, which says that a physical disability is a justification for you not having to submit to one of these tests. And if you have a fear that rises to the level of a physical problem such as fainting or vomiting, and these questions were asked, by the way, during cross-examination by the prosecutor in this case. When the needle was brought out, did the person show any signs of being, did Mr. Kriyoski throw up? Did he faint? Was there any reaction on the part of this person? And there was not. And so if it rises to the level of some sort of physiological inability to submit, that is one issue. Or if the person is a hemophiliac, or if the person perhaps has a religious objection, I have not looked into that very thoroughly in terms of whether that would constitute a reasonable objection, but it very well may. So the only time I would say that it, unless there's religious or physiological inability to submit, if there was the third ground is that I would say it could be a fear that doesn't rise to the level of either those two things if the fear was reasonable. The person is in the hospital, sees the nurse or the doctor pull out a needle from the trash can and is about to stick it in them. That's a reasonable fear. The doctor is drunk, whatever. Then you have grounds to be reasonably afraid in that situation. But I don't think simply a bald assertion, I'm afraid of needles, should cut it. And one reason for that is that drunk drivers will learn the magic words. And, you know, I think that those of you who have trial court experience or have been prosecutors or defense attorneys know that. Often these people are repeat offenders, and they know, for example, at the end of the 20-minute waiting period to belch and to start the waiting period over. You can manipulate the system, and if you know that all you have to say is, I'm afraid of needles, and that's going to get you out of a blood test, then the prosecution of drunk drivers is going to be in big trouble.
Counsel, I have a couple of areas of inquiry, but let me just start with the reasonableness. Obviously, reasonableness standard under the Fourth Amendment exists outside of bowling, but I want to take a look at the third prong of bowling and the reasonableness of the method to take the blood test. When I was reading background for this case, it appeared to me that maybe a law enforcement officer saying, if you don't agree, I'm going to force you to do it anyway, so do you agree? Which is, I think, essentially what happened here. Is that reasonable?
I believe it is. You might have a separate question, as the Court of Appeals examined in Krauss, on whether unreasonable force was used or threatened to be used. But simply because you inform a defendant of something that you have the lawful right to do, I don't think that that presents a constitutional problem or makes the method unreasonable.
You have the lawful right if it's, and I get to the second area, if it's an exigent circumstance. An exigent circumstance
is immediate danger of concealed weapons, no problem here, or destruction of evidence under the direct control of the accused. And that's that exigent circumstance that we're focusing on as it relates to dissipation of the blood alcohol content here. What do you do with the trial court's finding with regard to that? The trial court indicated the state also argues that a blood test is more timely available and therefore more appropriate under exigent circumstances. However, trial court continues, had the defendant's request for a different test been honored when made at Countryside Home, the breath test would be at least as timely as the blood test at Fort Atkinson Memorial Hospital. In other words, meet all the tests. Further, there is no evidentiary support of the state's position that triers of fact accept blood test results more readily than breath or urine analysis. What do you do with that? I mean, it seemed to me part of it was sufficiency of evidence, but there are arguments to be made that it's easier for the jury to understand the blood test, that the blood tests allow for less manipulation, and then the jury isn't tripped up by all that sort of stuff. But the trial court said no evidentiary support of the state's position has been introduced in this case to support those kinds of arguments, and that timeliness that I just read would have been no exigent circumstances if they would have taken the breath test.
I think those are findings that are based on the facts that are reasonable findings, and the state does not have any problem with that, and even if we did, we're sort of stuck with that as appellate attorneys. But I would say that as far as the second finding of fact that you mentioned, whether triers of fact more readily accept blood over breath, that doesn't get to the issues I raised in my brief and that Justice Sykes was talking about earlier with manipulation of the process, of the breath testing process, and manipulation later on, challenges to the breath tests in court. That goes to whether there's just a basic gut feeling on the part of jurors that breath, you know, that's troublesome, but blood, that's where the alcohol is.
Was there any evidentiary support at the state, made by the state in its position at the motion hearing, that generically there can be manipulation? I mean, was this part of the record in this case?
No, and that is why I cited authority in my brief to show that these are challenges that are based on the statute itself, the implied consent statute, and cases where people have raised these challenges, and I also cite a manual put out by a defense bar or a defense attorney where these sort of challenges are brought out. But I believe that just based on the 20-minute waiting period, that this court can take judicial notice of this 20-minute waiting period and the fact that certain things simply cannot happen during this 20-minute waiting period.
For instance, do you want us to take judicial notice that some defendants after 20 minutes belch? I mean, is that part of the record? I take it it is not. So do you want us to take judicial notice of that?
Well, the fact that you have an administrative code that says that these things cannot happen, and, you know, there is nothing in the record to indicate that, you know, X percentage of defendants do this, but I think it's a reasonable thing for this court to do is look at the fact that this is a process that's more subject to attack because you have this 20-minute waiting period.
So we take judicial. Now, I thought judicial notice could only be taken of matters that are subject to no dispute whatsoever.
And maybe judicial notice is not the proper phrase here. But I think that it's it's reasonable for this court to acknowledge that there are certain procedures that have to be complied with for a breath test that are not there for a blood test, and that therefore the challenges can be greater. And I also cite the implied consent statute and the fact that the breath testing machine is subject to certain regulations that you just do not have with a blood test, like the fact that it has to be every 120 days, there has to be certification, and the fact that the two samples have to be within 0.02 of each other. And also, the breath test requires a level of cooperation on the part of the defendant that simply is not there with a blood test. If you have an obstreperous drunk driver, or just an uncooperative, or a drunk driver who's too drunk to submit to a breath test, it's going to be very difficult for the officer to obtain evidence in a case. And so if you have a defendant who's insisting on a breath test but is too drunk to blow, or who can't even follow directions because he's so drunk, you're going to have big problems with trying to get that evidence. And that's not outside the realm of possibilities in these drunk driving cases. This man was a 0.219, and you know, the possibility of administering a breath test, I'm not sure what that would have been like in this case, frankly.
Ms. Nashold, if I may digress for a moment and go back to the questions that I was pursuing earlier, what is your position, if any, with respect to whether or not a refusal to take a test can result in a forcible withdrawal of blood by the state?
I think that issue has been clarified in Zilke, which you authored, and by cases either subsequent or in Scales as well.
What did I say in Zilke? I don't
That basically the implied consent law should not afford a defendant greater protections than under the Fourth Amendment, and that the whole reason for the implied consent law is to facilitate the gathering of evidence, and that therefore, simply because a person, there is a lack of compliance with the implied consent. Prohibit the officer from obtaining evidence by other lawful means. And that's established authority in the case law, but it's also in the implied consent statute itself. The implied consent statute
in sub 4?
That's right. Specifically states that it's sub 3C. This section does not limit the right of a law enforcement officer to obtain evidence by any other lawful means. So simply because you have a refusal, it does not mean you are barred from obtaining evidence under the Fourth Amendment, as long as it complies with the Fourth Amendment. They're designed to protect different interests. They're separate proceedings.
Are defendants told in this state that if you refuse to take the test, not only will you be subject to prosecution for refusal, but we will also forcibly take blood from you?
No, and not all officers do that either. It depends on the circumstances and perhaps on the severity of the crime. I could see instances where if it's a first time, the officers wouldn't bother to pursue. But this was the fifth offense for this man, and I don't think they probably would have said, okay, you refuse, so we're not going to pursue getting evidence from you. I just wanted to get back to this idea of exigent circumstances dissipating, because that is so fundamental to the defendant's position here. Simply because someone agrees to another test does not mean that the exigent circumstances somehow disappear. The alcohol is still dissipating. Even if a person agrees to another form of test, that does not bear on the issue at all of whether exigent circumstances exist. And what the defendant's position really amounts to here is that the defendant gets to control the method of investigation by the officer. That the defendant, by asserting, I will submit to breath, basically is directing the prosecution of the case. And I think that this court should be very loath to say that the defendant gets to choose what method of obtaining evidence is permissible by the officer. As long as it's a reasonable method, and it is here, then the officer should be able to pursue that course of obtaining evidence.
Do you take the position that once exigent circumstances have been established, they remain, that those circumstances will continue to exist regardless of circumstances that might follow?
No, I'm saying that they continue to exist in this case because alcohol is still dissipating.
Okay. So this is really a very narrow case then, that it's the dissipation of alcohol.
I believe it is. I believe that what has happened is that you have a brief submitted by the defendant that raises a number of issues, but then when it comes down to it, after the state submits its brief and the reply brief is filed, what it really has come down to is that there are no exigent circumstances here.
But let's assume that this defendant was arrested, and it was within moments after the arrest that this blood test or breath test was available. Now, we all know, I think, we can take judicial notice, that the relationship of alcohol in your blood will continue to increase for a while and then will decrease. But, it's not always dissipating, is it?
It's not always dissipating, but that is what the court addressed in Schmerber, and that's what this court was concerned with in Bowling, that exigency is created by the potential dissipation of alcohol. And it did not get into the issue of, well, there could be times, depending on the timing of the arrest and when he stopped drinking, that the alcohol level is increasing. But the exigent circumstances are based on the dissipation of alcohol, and that is what is occurring here.
Okay, but then doesn't Judge Irwin take the slats right out from underneath you when she says that, as a matter of fact, this breath test... could have been administered in a time in which you could have gotten an accurate reading?
I don't think it does. I don't think because a breath test was available that affects the exigent circumstances. That's talking about the method of execution of obtaining evidence.
But she's not saying that, that after 20 minutes if this guy belches, she's not creating a one belch rule or anything of that sort. She's simply saying that at that moment, you could have gotten an accurate test. Now, obviously, the defendant can do things that are going to affect that breath test. And the answer of Mr. Andreg, of course, is once that occurs, you're right back into an emergency situation, and then you can withdraw blood. But until that point occurs, why hasn't the emergency disappeared?
Because the alcohol is still dissipating. The alcohol is dissipating. It does. Just because the defendant prefers some kind of other test, it doesn't mean that exigent circumstances have ceased to exist. And once there are exigent circumstances, the officer should be allowed to obtain the evidence in any reasonable manner. And the legislature, the Supreme Court, this court has placed its imprimatur on blood draws, even where a person does not consent. And the fact that the legislature has specifically listed these three methods of obtaining evidence for OWI, blood, breath, or urine, indicates that the legislature, and lets the officer choose, indicates that the legislature saw these as essentially equivalent, and also that it was a good policy decision to let the officer choose, an experienced officer, decide which test is most appropriate under any given set of circumstances.
Let me see if I can state the state's position, okay? State's position is that we should follow State v. Bowling.
That's right.
That as a scientific fact, alcohol dissipates over a period of time, and that, as a scientific fact, creates an exigent circumstance. That is not adequate as such under Bowling. That's the start.
Right.
That gets you into, that's the start. Bowling sets forth four other issues, circumstances that you consider. You got exigent. Bowling
right.
gives you that, right? As I read Bowling. And you've got these four others, and we've gone through that. And then you can, there can be a debate into the facts of the case whether three or four here apply. The state's position is they don't. But then the state says we're not going to add a fifth circumstance
right.
under Bowling. And the fifth circumstance under Bowling that the defendant wants to add is that defendant, the accused, has not consented. The fifth circumstance would be has not consented in a reasonable way to another reasonable test.
Right.
And you're not willing to add that. The state's not willing to add that.
And the Court of Appeals recently said that in Wodenjack, too, that Bowling has these conditions, as long as they are met, that allow you to take the blood draw.
And those are the exclusive conditions, at least as presented here. Now, you know, somebody else may present another one in another case that we haven't foreseen, but not to add this condition to Bowling.
Right. You don't have to consider alternate tests.
That's right.
That's
even unconsented. That's not a condition we should add to Bowling.
Right.
And we shouldn't add it according to the state, because what that does is it allows the prosecutor, it allows the defendant to determine what evidence can be used against him instead of allowing the state to determine what evidence ultimately can be used against him.
Right. It also, it's not just the fact that the state likes this evidence better, it's the fact that the defendant is basically directing the investigation of the crime.
But the state does like blood better.
Well, you know, it depends. I mean, I believe that, for example, this is not in the record, but some counties still do breath, even for felony offenses, and I'm not sure why that is, but...
Well, both are acceptable
right.
in the court of law.
Right.
One may present more problems for the prosecutor than the other. Evidentiary problems, as set forth here, but it's okay evidence.
But I think the fact that there are so many counties that have policies regarding blood, we want blood if it's a serious offense, shows that they acknowledge that blood is less subject to attack. And that doesn't go to reliability. Ultimately, if the state can jump through all these hoops, then breath is more reliable for alcohol, and that's another very important issue, is that it does not test for drugs.
Counsel, have you, in some ways, rendered your argument, does it render the whole refusal statutory scheme meaningless? As a circuit court judge, I would either have a refusal charge or an OWI charge. And doesn't mean that I have to. I'm just telling you what my experience was. And that a defendant had a choice. The choice was you could refuse and be subject to the penalties of refusal, still go to trial, you know, of course, on the OWI charge, and you have the refusal charge. But you could refuse and be subject to those penalties, or you could take the test.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there is no choice now with regard to refusal. That's a meaningless option, because even if you would, why would anyone ever choose to refuse, because they can be forcibly made to take the test anyway? Just doesn't that render any choice for refusal absolutely absurd?
This case will not bear on that at all, because it's already been established under Zilke, under Scales, that you can pursue both a refusal and lawfully obtain evidence by other means, that basically they're separate proceedings, and the whole purpose, and this has been stated time and time again in various decisions, of the implied consent law is to facilitate the gathering of evidence and facilitate the prosecution of drunk drivers.
But what's the purpose of the refusal statutory scheme?
The the purpose of the refusal? Are you saying why would anyone...
No, why does the legislature have a statutory scheme that says if someone chooses to refuse, then these are the penalties that will be imposed?
Because they want to be able to revoke a person's license for refusing and to make it more difficult for a defendant to refuse.
And but the defendant really can't refuse. I shouldn't say that. A defendant, regardless of whether or not he refuses, will be subjected to take the test. So any choice of refusal is really, I get back to absurd. Isn't that correct?
That's not always true that the person will be subjected to a blood test. There may be situations where, for whatever reasons, the officer does not pursue that option. Maybe the hospital is going to be too far away, or maybe there's just a ton of evidence that this person is completely drunk and was driving drunk, and in those circumstances, it's not worth, especially if the person is very obstreperous and it's going to involve major restraints to try to take a blood test. It's not in every situation that a defendant is going to be undergo a forcible blood draw.
Got a sight on Zulke?
137 with second 39.
Thank you.
I see I'm out of time if there are no further
questions.
And that's
quoted in Nelson, in Krauss, I'm sorry.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nashhold. Mr. Anderick?
One of the issues that came up, excuse me.
Before you start, no one in this case, neither the state nor the defendant, is arguing that you can't take a blood test if there's no consent. That is, that the statute, the implied consent statute, bars taking a blood test if there's been a protest against the blood test. You're not arguing that the statute controls.
I'm not arguing that.
And the state's not arguing that.
I doubt it.
Okay. I just want to clarify what you're arguing about. Go ahead.
Thank you. One of the issues that came up in terms during the past argument is the question of exigent circumstances, and it's a definitional question. I think that is sort of the hang-up causing a problem here. The state defines exigent circumstances as the dissipation of alcohol in the bloodstream and leaves it at that. And using this inadequate definition allows the state to argue that the exigency doesn't go away when the suspect offers to give a breath test because, after all, alcohol continues dissipating in the bloodstream. The flaw in this argument is that it relies upon an incomplete definition of exigency. What gives rise to an exigency is more than the mere dissipation of alcohol, although that is obviously a critical element of it. It's the dissipation of alcohol concentration coupled with the inability to gain access to that information. It's the coexistence of those two circumstances which gives rise to an exigency. And once the suspect agrees to provide a breath sample, then the inability to gain access to the alcohol concentration of the suspect is gone, and the exigency no longer exists.
Well, the concept the dissent in bowling, and dissents don't win, right, by definition, is that it's not exigent because you could have gotten a search warrant in time in bowling. And the court said no, right?
Right.
So the court said no, get a search warrant. Why should the court now say yes because you could consent to a breathalyzer?
The question is, if the court said that you could, the fact that you could get a search warrant is not sufficient, why is it sufficient?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that...
Both really are saying that these circumstances are not exigent, right?
In the case that they're not exigent in the sense that the search warrant...
can be got. The reason that you don't want demand a search warrant is because there's not enough time to do it.
Right.
That's not case, at least if you agree with the dissent, was there was. So that didn't knock out exigent.
I think that in the case of the search warrant, you're dealing sort of with an unknown and hypothetical. You're not really, you're sort of imagining that the police may have time to get a search warrant, but you're not sure whether they're going to be able to reach somebody or, I mean, there's an unknown there. Here we have a known set of facts where we know that a breath test was available, was functioning, the defendant was willing to submit to it, and it was every bit as expedient as a blood test as found by the trial court.
Can I ask you then, is it correct to say that your position is to add a fifth category under bowling?
I don't really think that you need to add a fifth category under bowling. It certainly could be taken care of with a sort of a reasonableness argument. But there is this discussion about I'm afraid of needles and is that sufficient enough to make the objection reasonable. Well, I would note, first of all, that the trial court made a factual finding that the defendant had a fear of needles and that's part of the record. But that's not really the issue, and to answer your question, I think that this can be taken care of under the fourth prong of bowling because I think the objection is, in this case, is reasonable, not because of the fear of needles. I think really the fear of needles is almost irrelevant to this issue. What made the objection reasonable in this case under the fourth prong of bowling is that it came with a simultaneous offer to submit to a breath test, which was available and timely and every bit as good from an evidentiary standpoint in Wisconsin as the blood test would be. So I would say you don't really need to add a fifth prong to bowling. It could come under the fourth prong. I would also reject the idea that we should use this ability to submit to a test and somehow engraft the statutory language of our implied consent law on constitutional analysis in this case. Am I out of time?
Thank you, Mr. Anderegg. Thank you, Ms. Nashold. That concludes our hearing in 99-31.